name is Clancy Innocent, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here tonight, safe, sane, and sober.
I think this has been a fine convention. It's been exciting.
Most exciting meeting. I'm sure some of you didn't attend. It was yesterday afternoon, 4 o'clock, on that stage. There was a fine panel talking about whether AA has changed. And then they made a mistake. They threw a microphone open to the inmates. And then it started to get exciting. And some nice Al-Anon lady was really concerned whether or not AA should take Valium. And I got made my mouth water just to hear it. Somebody asked if, some young lady who asked if, why they had all these old fools on the podium, 25 years sober, no young people. And I thought the leader did a good job. He mentioned that if you're new, you can't really tell if AA is changing. You have to have some time on the program to get any sort of a perspective. But it was a good meeting, and there was a fine meeting last night. I hope all of you had a chance to attend it with the charming and lovely representative of the General Service Offices in New York, who I've heard speak before, and she is always, I'm always interested in what she says. And the fine meetings today, excellent institutional meeting today, good meeting this afternoon, in which the young lady, well, she's not young, she said she started drinking 48 years ago, I heard her say that, but she looked young from where I sat. I got a problem? No, well, can't call bad eyes a problem. But she gave an excellent talk. I think it's been a fine finish. I'm sure we're going to have some fine meetings tomorrow because I know all of the speakers. I know them personally away from the podium. Rosa, who is kind of has been an AA long enough now to say anything she damn well wants to say and get away with it. And the fine Al-Anon speaker from Oklahoma, who I had dinner with tonight. And I've met her many, many times. And Harry from San Diego. But we are here primarily, not really to just call the roll of meetings, but to remember, I'm here to remember why I'm here. I'm here, as I said, because I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. Because I didn't used to be, and as I like to say, I may not be sober again sometime because the streets are full of people who used to be safe and sane and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and aren't anymore. The indispensable members of groups who the group couldn't exist without them, somehow the group exists without them. People sometimes stay sober as long as 6 months. If you're new, can you imagine someone staying sober 6 months and getting along well and then drinking? And sometimes they stay sober as long as a year, sometimes longer than that. I think one of the more poignant things I ever ran across was in 1970 at the International Convention in Miami Beach. I ran across a little old Irish lady, and she was crying, and she had come over from Ireland. She had lived in the United States and gone back to Ireland. She came back for the International Convention to see her sponsor. And she was 29 years sober. She got to Miami Beach, and she asked somebody from Cleveland about him, and he had gotten drunk the week before, after 33 years of sobriety. He had gotten sober in 1937 and got drunk. And it's a funny thing. AA loses a lot of people to drinking. In fact, that's an interesting thought, I think. We get so immersed, are we getting enough of the new people in? I don't know how it is in Arizona, but in my state, I haven't been to a meeting in literally years, but there haven't been new people at the meeting. We're getting an awful lot of new people. I think the problem that we sometimes forget is we lose them at the top because we somehow feel that if we get them sober, somehow they're going to be all right. And it is incumbent upon me to remember for myself that being sober does not mean that I'm going to be sober. Or the fact that I'm at this meeting tonight will not mean that I'm going to be sober. Or the fact that I'm attempting to work the principles of AA does not indicate I'm going to be sober. Because people get out of AA little by little. They don't just jump out when they've been sober a while. They ease out. They get out little by little. The year after I was at Miami Beach, I was up in Cleveland talking at some anniversary for Sister Ignatia or something and commemorating her death or something. And I made a point of looking up this guy. And he had just died without ever getting back. And I asked about him, and it turned out he hadn't been to a meeting for 4 years before he got drunk. But his reason was pretty good. Hey, baby, I helped write that book. What do I have to do to keep sitting in them damn meetings, getting, you know, he stopped smoking, and that smoke bothers the eye. And what's there to tell him? What's some dummy gets up saying, I used to drink, and now I stay sober. When you've heard it for 30 years, you shouldn't have to keep sitting in there, should you? But apparently you guess you have to do. Because that's what happens. So there's another... Yesterday, the leader mentioned that... Or someone mentioned on that panel and yesterday afternoon. I remember the word that struck me in a different way. That Alcoholics Anonymous is a paradox. And it certainly is a paradox in another way. And that paradox is... I don't think there's anybody in this room who's been sober very long who would question the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program. It certainly is a non-material program, a thing of the spirit. And one of the funny ways that people get out of AA is that somehow they come here and find some spiritual values, and the next thing you know, they grow right out the other side. They become too spiritual for AA. They just... wonderful. And there was a woman who said hell at a meeting last week, and I can't go there. And one of the classic lines is, I now walk alone with God. And it's pretty hard to debate that, you know. But I'll tell you something else that's kind of funny. People who become too spiritual to do the things that alcoholics have to do to stay sober and who walk alone with God, in my experience, apparently, every so often, God leans over and says, why don't you have a beer, kid? Yeah. Away they go. People come here sometimes so spiritually starved that when they get some spiritual value, they think that they've got something nobody else ever had. And people drift away little by little. And people have a difficult time sometimes in maintaining interest in them same damn old 12 steps and them damn 12 traditions and still another goofy newcomer to deal with tonight at the meeting. Oh, Jesus, come on. We're here to find love, not to listen to you. And it's understandable. I don't suppose anybody maintains a consistent interest. If they would, there'd be something more than human. But I'm glad that I'm here tonight, safe and sane and sober, and I hope I remember that. I didn't always know that, and I might forget it sometime in the future. There was one other thing I wanted to mention tonight, and I did want to get it in before I forgot it, because I think it should be part of any talk. I used to drink alcohol. I think I kind of slid over that in my sermon tonight. But I'm here because I used to drink alcohol. And I drank alcohol not because I was an alcoholic, but because I had certain emotional dislocations that most people don't understand. Laugh if you want to, but it goddamn near killed me. I had my first drink of alcohol. I remember it very well. I had my first drink when I was 15 years old, just coming up to 16, and I was in the spring of 1943. I grew up in I always like to give this town a little juice, the only juice it gets. I grew up in a little town in northern Wisconsin called Eau Claire. It's a lovely little town. It's the type of town you see in Andy Hardy movies. It's just two-story houses, and the streets are just tunnels of green trees, and there's lawns you don't have to water because it rains and things like that. And two little rivers come together there and form another river which wends its way down to the Mississippi. And as boys, we used to have rafts and go out and be like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. And in the summertime, you hear them go to sleep at night to the crickets chirping, and it's lovely in the soft, warm air. And the autumn, everything just turns to gold and crimson, and the trees are beautiful. And I think one of the most poignant smells of all is smelling the smell of burning leaves in that kind of a climate. It smells very much like marijuana, actually. But I hadn't smelled any marijuana. It smells like burning leaves is what it smells like. And in the wintertime, the snow falls, and it looks, the whole town looks like a Christmas card. There's little wisps of smoke coming out of, there's little steeples coming out of the snow, and there's kids with sleds and rosy cheeks and snowsuits. In the springtime, the snow belts and the flowers. I remember spring because that's when you start to smell lilacs. When you smell lilacs, you know spring is here. You know, it's that time of year when you're a boy that you know you're going to fall in love and you just hope it's with somebody you like this year. Some dullard that's been sitting in front of you for 4 years, this year you'll love her. And it's just a wonderful town. It's the kind of town that everybody dreams of. And I'll tell you, I just couldn't wait to get out of that goddamn place. I just couldn't stand it. Even then, I was weird. I wanted to be out where the lights are going. I want to have fun and excitement and things. And in the spring of my junior year of high school, I was 15. I didn't know much about the world. What I knew about the world was there was a war on because and it seemed romantic. I learned about the war by reading Life magazine and seeing exotic places like the palm trees on Guadalcanal and the colorful burnouses in North Africa, and really exciting. And what I knew about the world, I'd seen at the State or Badger Theaters in downtown Eau Claire and learned about the world from the movies. And I just wanted to get out there. In some sort of hideous fit of go, in the Easter vacation of 1943, I told my mother I was going to go up to Superior and visit my aunt and uncle. And instead, I just hitchhiked all the way to San Francisco. And I always run across bad guys immediately. I'm lucky to do that. And he showed me how to get some phony identification showing I was older than I was. And with that, I got some Seaman's papers. They were crying for merchant seamen. And the day after I was in San Francisco, I was on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And about one day out of port, I suddenly realized, oh, Jesus. This isn't it either, really. And I went and told the captain that I wanted to go home. I really wanted my mother, but I didn't want to say that. And I was short and skinny, and I had a face full of pimples, and I was very hip in Eau Claire, but out here I was really something less. And the captain told me he told me that he could not turn back because of my request, and he suggested I continue with my duties of chipping the paint. And he said words I'd never heard in Eau Claire. And that day I was assigned to a forecastle. A forecastle is a room on a ship where people sleep. And in there were four people, I and three others. And these other three were the worst type, the type of people I always had envied or resented. And it's the type you just can't do anything with. They're men. Grown up men. And the type of man you don't see in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Men with black hair. Italians. Mexicans. Funny things, not Norwegians. And I was really a little sick about that. And the first day out in this forecastle, I remember this because it happened, and I always try to remember it. Remember the guy reaching into a sea bag and taking out a bottle of whiskey and saying to one of these other boobs,
You want a little snort? The guy said, yeah. So how about you? You want a little snort? The guy said, yeah. Then he turned to me and he said, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough to take a little snort? And he stuck that bottle in my face. And I looked up at him and I gave him the mini ray with my watery blue eyes. And I thought, you big fool. Asked me if I wanted to drink whiskey. In the first place, Lutherans don't drink whiskey. Baptists may, Catholics do, but Lutherans don't. And even if Lutherans did drink whiskey, I wouldn't, because I'd promised my mother I wouldn't. And besides that, you know, good guys don't drink whiskey. Bad guys drink whiskey. Buck Jones doesn't drink whiskey. Rustlers named Slade drink whiskey. They get together. Come on, let's look at Buck Jones. Errol Flynn doesn't drink whiskey. Turned out he did later, but Robin Hood doesn't drink whiskey. Basil Rathbone, the Sheriff of Nottingham, drinks whiskey. And that guy stuck that bottle in my face, a clean-cut Lutheran who knows better. He says, are you man enough? And I looked right up at him and I said, goddamn right. I've always been very bad with peer pressure. So that day I had my first drink of whiskey, and it, oh, bad news, baby. Burned my mouth, burned my throat, burned my stomach, turned around, burned my stomach, burned my throat, burned my mouth, burned my nose, my ears, my hair. And I remember being sick, but it's something I remember much more than that. I can hear it almost as though it were yesterday. Their scornful, sneering laughter. What's the matter, Junior? Not man enough? There's nothing you can do. I thought later I might get one of them to lean over. Say, hey, lean over, buddy. I got something for you. Hey, shoot him a blackhead in the eye. See if that slowed him down. But I didn't, thank heaven. And I really felt bad. I felt inadequate and weak anyway, and that made it all the worse. And as with most things in my life, it's always the next thing. If I can do the next thing, I'll be all right. And the next thing it seemed to me to be was that I wonder if I could hold down a drink of that slop. And all the way across the Central Pacific in the hot, in the heat of late April and May of 1943, I snuck into that guy's sea bag every day when somebody wasn't around and took a drink to try to hold one down. And it'd come back up. And I'd take another drink to hold one down. And it'd come back up. And I hated the taste of it. I hated how it tasted. I hated everything about it. But I had just become obsessed. Those guys are never going to know that I'm really equal until I can have a drink. And a day out of Pearl Harbor, I took a drink one day. That day, and it went down, made me sick, terrible. I started to throw up, and I didn't. It stayed down. And it just about killed me. Hot, stinking, lousy, rotten stuff. But I got thinking, now I'll somehow get one of those guys to offer me a drink, and I'll pretend I like it. And I'll go, that's good. Boy, that hits the spot. They'll say, hey, that kid's all right. If I can just get him this, what'll they think? Will that sell him on the idea? And as I was thinking about what they were thinking, the first of the maybe 10,000 miracles that AA did in my life transpired that morning. As I was standing there thinking about that, I noticed my stomach started to get warm. And my fingertips went tingly-poo. And my toes tingled. I gained about 6 inches in height. And my pimples fell off. And I'm all of a sudden I found myself thinking, who cares what those dummies think? And then I got sick and threw up again. But for a brief moment, maybe a minute and a half or 2 minutes, I had found the feeling that it looked to me like everybody else had naturally. The feeling of being something. And from then on, I drank. I didn't get drunk a lot. Especially when I was a kid, I didn't drink a great deal. I learned to drink. I, like every other kid learns to drink. I drank more than I should sometimes. It made me feel, but it always did the job for me a little bit. And later in the war, I went in the Navy. And I got old enough. And when I was in the Navy, I took some examinations at the through the Armed Forces Institute, so I didn't have to go back and be a junior in Eau Claire High School. And I got out of the Navy in the spring of 1946. I started college at the University of California on the GI Bill. And I still was the dumbest kid in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I really didn't get along there well at all. And I drank too much trying to be a man to prove I was a veteran. I got expelled. And right after that, I just going to go see the world. I wound up in Tucson, Arizona, of all places. I lived downtown the YMCA. My diet got to be one thing. I learned my first word of Spanish. Dame un perro caliente. I ate them goddamn hot dogs continually because that's all I could eat. And I hung, and I, at that time in 1946, the American Legion Hall was right around the corner from the YMCA down an alley. And I went over there and played piano and get guys to buy me drinks and really, it was a dummy thing. And finally, on Easter morning of 1946, the day before that, I ran across a guy who says, I live in Pennsylvania. Come over to my house. And so I said, how are we going to get there? He says, I know how to ride freight trains. Haven't you ever ridden freight trains? I said, no, I never rode a freight train. He said, you're going to learn today, baby. And Easter morning, 1946, he and I left Tucson on a freight train. And we finally got to Pennsylvania. I never got back to Tucson until yesterday. I still got some change coming from one of my hot dogs. That's why I'm here. And, I went to his house. Not silly, but finally I got myself together. In the fall of my, I went to college in the GI Bill. I went back and I became I put my efforts to work to become something. And, I drank all this time. And I did become something in college. In Wisconsin, I got married in college and I had a couple little kids and I discovered something I didn't know I could do as well as the coach thought I could, and I got good coaching, and I became member of a national intercollegiate championship team, and I was active in edited the yearbook, and all the things that you do in college to be kind of a big man on campus. And after the war, after I got out of college, I became a sports writer on newspapers, and then I got into corporate work, into writing, and then advertising and advertising agencies, and I became kind of successful. I got into some big agencies, and one time I was teaching in a college at night, working in an advertising agency in the daytime, and writing a weekly column besides, and had more kids and drank all this time. And I'll tell you a secret. To the best of my ability to judge, alcohol was the best friend I ever had, and it made it possible. I really felt that. Alcohol gave me the edge I needed to go out in that world and reduce my inhibitions that held me, reduce my fear, and so on. And I do feel, alcohol was the best friend I ever had, I felt. Women come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. But a double shot is always a double shot. Or a martini. Or a glass of wine. Or whatever it may be. And I some years later, I took my last drink. And about a year ago, I was talking to some dummy newcomer one day. And I get referrals from around the country. People say, you're too sick for us. Go to Los Angeles. Look up Clancy. So I really get a nice crop. And I was trying to explain to this guy. He was telling me about his emotions. I was talking about my emotions. And I found myself saying something that I had never thought of all the time I drank and all the time after I was sober for years and years. But suddenly I heard myself saying, it's really true. I took my last drink, as far as I can look at it now, for exactly the same reason I took my first drink. To feel grown up in a grown-up world and to be able to filled that hole in my gut. I had much better reasons to describe it by the time I took my last drink. I'd been in analysis for some time. I'd had medications. I'd had deep psychoanalytical progress. I'd been into metaphysics. I got into philosophy. Man, when you read philosophy, you know truth. If you're dissatisfied with life, read Nietzsche, and you'll feel better, because to me, Nietzsche was just wonderful. I enjoyed what he said. He has some wonderful things out, such as Nietzsche in 1884 wrote a treatise proving that God was dead. And by the time I read it, I was glad to hear it. Because if he wasn't, I was screwed. That's a long, beautiful treatise. And, you know, in fact, there's a very famous plaque in the Union Theological Seminary in Chicago that says, God is dead, signed Wilhelm Friedrich Nietzsche, 1884. And beneath it, it says, Nietzsche is dead, signed God, 1906. But at any rate, you don't... But I never could conceive that I was drinking. You know, it's okay to feel grown up when you're 15 and your face is full of pimples and you're a dummy punk. But after you're grown up and getting bald and wrinkled, and you got four kids growing up, and you're sitting behind a door with your name in letters of gold on it that people have to knock on before they come in, Mr. Immislin, you shouldn't have to drink to feel grown up then. But I drank to feel grown up, and it did the job for me. And I tell you that, in a real sense, my drinking was always for the same reason. I suppose I could phrase it a little bit differently, because it would say the same thing, but it would cover it a little more expansively. I could say, for instance, that I drank to redress the imbalance I felt between myself and my environment. And that would be less accurate, because that really is what it boils down to. And I succeeded relatively well all these years, didn't I? There was no problem with drinking, except once in a while, and then it wasn't really a problem with drinking. I had some problems, and I had problems as far back as I can remember. But my problems were not that of alcohol. In fact, I went to some guy took me to my first AA meeting in 1949. And I knew that I wasn't like those old fools. You know, they were old fools. In their 30s and 40s, burnt out old fools. And the guy said, I stayed drunk on alcohol for 25 years. And then I am sober today. I'm just so glad. I thought, Jesus. Yeah. Certainly glad you got a place to go, you old fool. But it's got nothing to do with me, because I got my life ahead of me, and I did it. And as the years went by, the reason I went into analysis, the reason I went into metaphysics, before metaphysics were big, at that time there were only six of us who knew truth in Dallas. Before I went into philosophy, and the only reason I went into it was for this reason. Because I had some emotional imbalances that made me feel bad a lot of the time. And these emotional imbalances were nothing to do with anything that I could find identifiable. They dealt with emotions that apparently, as far as I could see, other people didn't seem to have. For instance, how do you explain to somebody, I often get the feeling that I don't really fit in like other people do? Now, that isn't much of a thing to say. What's your problem? Oh, I don't feel I fit in. Oh, really? Huh? I sometimes have gnawing feelings of secret feelings, carefully hidden, but feelings of inadequacy sometimes. Just inadequacy. But the only way I ever found to beat that feeling is to take he or she or them to who I feel inadequate and find ways to tear them down in my mind and criticize them till I can make myself feel superior to them. That's why people always put down a lot of things they don't understand, because they're a little afraid of it. In fact, that's one of the strange things about my life. I look over my life, and maybe some of you have this feeling. I remember most of my life, all of my life just about, I felt either beneath or above. Beneath or above. One thing I never have any memory of feeling was is equal. Equal on a continuing basis. And I have feelings of inadequacy. I get afraid sometimes, and I can't even identify what it is. It's just kind of a Dodie said, and she's had a lot of free-floating anxieties. That's what they are, free-floating anxieties. You just somehow you feel something's going to happen, and you're afraid of it, and you don't know what it is. And those are the sort of things you can't tell people about. I used to kind of chuckle sardonically to myself, think, because I went to AA meetings every once in a while for year after year because the heat was on. They, a lot of people thought I had a drinking problem, but I knew I didn't. But, you know, what if I went down to one of them AMA meetings and one of them old silver-haired boobs came over to me? How are you doing, son? Oh, I have a secret feeling of inadequacy. How are you getting along? Oh, I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? Beat the shit out of me. I don't know I'm afraid of. They're getting an 11-foot pole to touch you with, baby. You know, these are secret emotions. What is it when you don't fit in? When other people seem to instinctively know how to get along, and I can for a while, but it comes and goes. To not really know how to act. I felt sometimes in my life as though when I was old and supposed to be wise and had some degree of respect, that I felt almost sometimes in situations as unversed in what to do as I did when I got on that ship and trying to watch what those guys were doing to act grown up. You know, when you get kids and you take them to the park and you have to kind of look out of the corner of your eye at other fathers to see what fathers do with kids because you're not certain that your feelings are right. When your little girl eats a dead bird, should you offer to help her or bite it or slap her or what the hell to do, you know? But I became kind of successful because these problems and anxiety and loneliness and not fitting in and fear are the feelings that I equate with prolonged sobriety. And they weren't caused in my life by drinking. They were healed by drinking. And when it gets bad enough, you take a few drinks, and it eases them off. And you can go in and do what you got to do, and even if you can't do it, you feel like you can do it. And sometimes that fools people right there. In fact, that's what, you know, it always is kind of amazing to me now. I didn't know it then, but one of the great cries you hear around AA every once in a while from some beleaguered soulless, I'm not really an alcoholic. I'm a social drinker. Or, why have I been cursed with this illness? Social, if I could have been a social drinker. There's such a demand around here to be a social drinker sometimes. You just don't know what's happening. If you want to be a social drinker, you're just not aware. Can you imagine what it must be like to be a social drinker? When you feel bad and take a drink, you still feel bad. Is that what you want out of life? It's hard for us to know. We're among the very lucky 6 or 7% that alcohol changes. You could be a, you know, that's why those fools can leave a half-empty glass on a bar and walk out. Oh, that's all I want. Whereas most of us can hear from 2 rooms away a little voice saying, I'm in here on the piano. But I knew this all those years. My problem is not alcohol, and when I use alcohol wisely, I can overcome my problems and become something. Unfortunately, however, sometimes the pressures are too great and the Pharisees are too intense. And sometimes There's too much injustice. I've always been a great believer in justice. That's one of the hallmarks of being young, that you want justice. I demand justice! Justice for the whole world! So if you haven't got enough for everybody, give me mine. As you get older and wiser, you begin to realize that's the last thing in the world you want. Any more justice and I'm wiped out, baby. The cry becomes, mercy, good breaks, you know, something. No more justice. But I wanted justice. And sometimes the intensities of my emotions were such, they didn't all come in nice little packages, they just come with bloop, bloop. You never know what way to look for the damn things. You could be feeling good and just have somebody look at you funny and it just makes you wonder, what do they mean by that? That sometimes I drank too much. And sometimes I got drunk. With the sensitivities I had, it's no wonder I got drunk. And then well-meaning people would go up to me and say, you have a problem with alcohol. Now, if you just quit drinking, everything will be all right. And when they say that, you immediately know they don't know. My problem is not drinking. My problem is perhaps call it moods, call it injustice, call it lousy stinking break, call it rotten stinking cheap hypocritical society. But if I... It isn't alcohol, but these moods sometimes got me, and I had funny things happen to me. Like in the spring of 1954, I was a young up-and-coming guy in the Midwest, and I was man of the year for my writing, and I was some kind of brilliant young advertising executive, I'll tell you. In July of 1954, I got an award as the man of the year. But unfortunately, some of my moods got a hold of me. And by December of 1954, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not putting that down. But it's very hard to work into your resume later, I'll tell you that. That's why most people like me have big areas in their resume where it says self-employed or freelance. And finally, I ran into that guy that taught me how to run freight trains, ride freight trains. He was in San Francisco. And I ran into him in January of 1955. And he said, hey, baby, I'm going to El Paso. I graduated from Texas Western College. And I'm going down to take some graduate work. Come on along. We'll hitchhike. And I had a wife and kids stuck away in the Midwest. But I figured they probably couldn't send me any money. So we hitchhiked. And I got to El Paso. We hitchhiked in El Paso in January of 1956 or 55. And I'm going to tell you something. I was full of zeal to make a new start. And I got a job in the El Paso Times as a reporter. And then after that, I got into an agency, advertising agency called Mithoff Advertising Agency in El Paso. And by May of 1956, I had my wife and family in there, had another kid. I was at the faculty of Texas Western at night, working in an advertising agency in the daytime and writing a weekly column for the El Paso Times. Now, that isn't bad for hitchhiking in your T-shirt a year and a half before. And I really had it together, except unfortunately, I had an attack of one of my moods. Now, I had been drinking successfully all the time I was there, but when these moods come, I get weird. And a month and a half later, I was no longer on the faculty of the University of Texas El Paso. I was in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. And I was not in there for an alcohol problem. I was in there as a suicide, because one of my moods got me into a suicidal depression. And I had promised not to drink. If I drank, I was going to lose all three of my jobs. So I couldn't drink, and I stayed sober too long. And when I stay sober too long with my moods, I kill myself. And that's a terrible place to be in the big... You know, we had a speaker on the panel one of the meetings ago, a guy moved out here from Odessa, which is just a few miles from the Big Spring. That's a terrible nut house to be in, and it's bad enough to have to go to Texas to work, you know, without... And I was supposed to be in this nut house till I got cured. And I could see that this was going to be a long pull. And they told me, this is an escape-proof hospital. And that's all I need to do to get motivated. It is? I just forgot that a few weeks before I was killing myself. And it took me 2 weeks to break out of the nut house at Big Spring, Texas. How to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the fence. And the fox was loose. But the sad thing is, it isn't until you get out that you realize it really is an escape-proof nut house, but you don't know till you get out. So I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but you suddenly look around and realize they can see you running for 3 days. And then you're out. And you feel like such a dummy in your white bathrobe, just... And you know it's just a matter of time till those field glasses pick you up. They're... Well, there goes that little Yankee son of a bitch now. And they pulled me back and they moved me to the electroshock ward and I never tried to run away again. It took me a long time to get out of that institution. A long time. I probably never would have got out. But I finally found one day, after I'd been there a number of months, I'd had some jobs in the hospital. They saw my record. I'd directed a grand opera at the Texas Western, so they had me direct a Christmas pageant in the Nut House. You know, about a second grade level, so the entire student body could get each nuance of the performance. The director's main job on that show was to try to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary who got the curtain open. You know, no, Lamar. You're supposed to worship her. No. Yeah. And I started a hospital newspaper, and I was the campus mailman, and I was doing everything. I almost got out, except every time I was just about ready to get out, I got upset. It moved me back a class or two. I was in that Ward 9 for God knows how long. And I discovered, they set up the first alcoholic ward in the state of Texas at Big Spring State Hospital that year. And I heard about that. And there were alcoholics coming in, and those AMAs were running it. And all these guys were coming in for a 30-day commitment and going home. And I asked about maybe going over there because I needed help. And they said, no, we don't accept psychiatric commitments. You have to be here in the alcoholic commitment program. I thought, if I could only hustle, because I'd been in around AA meetings for 7 years by now, whenever the heat was on. People thought I had a drinking problem. I discovered during those years that alcoholics almost had...